Donald Trump claims he can't get a fair trial with the current judge overseeing the latest case on charges of election fraud.
The fake charges put forth by the Biden sham, we call it a sham indictment.
Plus, Russia unleashes a barrage of missile and drone strikes against Ukraine, retaliating for an attack on a tanker.
About a half dozen people were killed, and a blood donation center in Kharkiv was hit.
And call her Billionaire Barbie. The film rakes in a record in ticket sales at U.S. movie theaters. Today is Monday, August 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. Former U.S. President Donald Trump contended Sunday that the federal judge randomly picked to oversee the trial accusing him of conspiring to overturn his 2020 re-election defeat wouldn't be fair to him and should be replaced. At a campaign appearance Saturday night, Trump said he has the right to challenge his loss while also criticizing the special counsel who's brought criminal charges against him.
The fake charges put forth by the Biden sham, we call it a sham indictment, and the man that's doing it, I really believe he's mentally ill. But these are outrageous, and it is an outrageous criminalization of political speech.
Trump also said the case should be moved out of Washington, where jurors would be picked from residents who overwhelmingly voted against him. Meanwhile, his attorneys say they will oppose federal prosecutors' requests to limit what they can share publicly about Trump's latest indictment. The case, as historic as it is, hasn't received much response globally. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias talked to political analysts about why that might be.
A sham is how former President Donald Trump, who is running again for the job, described his latest indictment when he rallied on Saturday in front of his supporters in Columbia, South Carolina. Last week, he appeared in court for allegedly conspiring to overturn his presidential election loss in 2020. The prosecution will have a hard time proving that, argued Trump's lawyer, John Lauro, on ABC's This Week show.
Whether or not he was acting corruptly, whether or not he was acting with the consciousness of guilt, with criminal intent. They'll never be able to prove that.
After Trump posted online what appeared to be a revenge promise on anyone who goes after him, prosecutors asked a federal judge to limit the information he and his team can publicly share about the case. The legal team has until Monday to respond. Laura commented on CNN.
The press and the American people in a campaign season have a right to know what the evidence is in this case, provided that this evidence is not protected otherwise. So we're going to oppose it.
Former Vice President Mike Pence, who is also a presidential hopeful and could be called to testify in the case, explained on CNN why he rejected Trump's lawyers' requests to overturn the 2020 election.
No vice president or any one person should ever have the right to choose the American president. The presidency belongs to the American people and the American people alone.
Global reactions to Trump's legal challenges have been slow in coming. James Long, professor of political science at the University of Washington, isn't surprised.
Some leaders in specific countries have sort of internalized the wrong message from Trump's behavior thus far. But I think right now, they're probably wise to stay quiet and let this process play itself out as they continue to try to have healthy diplomatic relationships with the United States.
Even though people abroad might be tired of hearing about it or think it might not be consequential, Trump's latest indictment should be taken seriously, according to Catherine Sicking, international relations specialist at Harvard Kennedy School.
If you don't have a democracy or your democracy is weak, human rights are imperiled. So I believe that in the long term, if this is handled well in the United States, other countries will pay attention.
In her view, the issue could become an example of how the U.S. is able to overcome its problems using the law. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Russian forces have been pounding cities in western Ukraine as Moscow made good on its promise to retaliate for a Ukrainian drone attack on a Russian tanker in the Black Sea late Friday. Associated Press correspondent Jackie Quinn has this report.
Ukraine's Air Force was showing off its firepower, but Russian fighters unleashed a barrage of missiles and drones from the air and sea. About a half dozen people were killed, and a blood donation center in Kharkiv was hit. President Volodymyr Zelensky denounced that as a war crime. There was shelling in the Donetsk region, which set a university building on fire. Despite the carnage, Zelensky is praising his Air Force.
Occupante.
For destroying some 4,000 Russian air targets. But he reminds Western allies his country still needs more air defense systems. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Meanwhile, talks hosted by Saudi Arabia on the Ukraine conflict concluded on Sunday without any concrete action beyond a commitment to continue future consultations in favor of peace. Across the globe, we've been witnessing record-breaking heat, torrential rains and flooding, and devastating wildfires, which scientists say are intensifying due to human-induced climate change. So far, world leaders have yet to come to meaningful agreements on reducing fossil fuel emissions, as experts warn urgent action is needed or things will continue to get much worse. I spoke with Peter Glick, senior fellow and co-founder of the Pacific Institute, about what kind of future we can expect and if this is the new normal.
There's nothing normal about what we're experiencing now. Everything is out of whack, and it's out of whack because climate change is now accelerating out of control. What we're seeing, all of these extreme events, is all related to the fact that humans are changing the climate, and we're now obviously suffering the consequences. So it's not a new normal in the sense that there's nothing normal about it, and it's not the new normal in the sense that it's not going to settle down to a steady state again. It's going to continue to get worse.
But what does it mean for life on Earth? What do you see going forward?
Well, what's happening is things are going to get more difficult. We're going to see, for humans and ecosystems, more and more stressful and damaging conditions. It's going to require a lot of money and time to try and adapt to the changes that we're experiencing. And in places where we can't adapt, it's going to lead to more suffering. You know, it's not as though this is a total surprise to climate scientists who've been arguing about these things and warning about these things for decades. But what we're seeing now is really a sort of a stunning combination of events that it really ought to be a wake-up call. It's just time to stop denying that these things are going to happen or are happening, and to stop denying that humans are responsible. We're seeing the consequences of our actions now. The value of any debate now has got to be how to respond to it more quickly than our politicians have responded in the past. They've ignored these warnings for decades, and now we're seeing the results.
Is there anything realistically that can be done to prevent warming from getting worse?
So absolutely, there are things that can and should and will be done. We are seeing a very rapid transition in our energy system away from fossil fuels. Not rapid enough, but rapid. You know, countries are building renewable energy systems far faster than we thought we would a few years ago, because the prices have come down and because there is a growing awareness of the threat. But much more needs to be done, and much more can be done more quickly. Politicians have to pull their heads out of the sand, look around at what's happening, look around at what can be done, and implement policies to do it. There's no more time to waste.
Can we reverse any of this or just prevent it from getting worse?
Well, we have to prevent it from getting worse, and we have to adapt to those changes that we can no longer prevent. We have to do both of those things. In the very, very long run, we can slowly reverse some of these changes by reducing the level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But the first thing we have to do is stop putting them there in the first place.
What about all of the things that are so interconnected as far as biodiversity on this planet? We hear about coral reefs drying up, glaciers melting. What happens if we lose some of these vital ecosystems?
Well, we are losing these ecosystems, and we're losing species. We're learning how interconnected all of the planet's systems are. You know, the climate's connected to water, and it's connected to energy, and it's connected to food and agriculture, and it's connected to the health of our natural ecosystems, and we're disrupting the entire system. The climate of the planet is the entire system we live in, and as we disrupt it, we're seeing the consequences in our oceans and in our ecosystems and in our forests, and I'm hopeful that this truly won't spin out of control, that we'll get this under control, but we're going to lose a lot of things along the way. These impacts are not only on natural systems, but they're on human systems as well. They're on human health. We already see a huge upsurge in heat-related deaths because of these heat events. We already see growing pressure on food production for a lot of different reasons because of changes in water availability and higher temperatures and increased storms. Changes in food availability is a real threat to the health and safety of communities around the world. We're going to continue to see expansion of certain kinds of diseases. You know, malaria has now appeared in Florida for the first time, not from tourists who go abroad, but from the spread of insects that carry malaria. We haven't seen natural malaria in the United States for decades, and it's back. We're going to see more and more of these direct health-related impacts on humans as the climate continues to worsen.
That was Peter Glick, Senior Fellow and Co-Founder of the Pacific Institute. We're following these other stories from around the world. Niger closed its airspace Sunday until further notice, citing the threat of military intervention from the West African Regional Bloc after coup leaders rejected a deadline to reinstate the country's ousted president. Japan on Sunday marked the 78th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing on Hiroshima. Commemorating the victims of the world's first nuclear attack, its mayor urged the abolition of nuclear weapons. And the United States played its best game of this Women's World Cup, but it wasn't good enough to stop the reigning champions from being eliminated in the round of 16. The Americans' bid to win a third consecutive title ended Sunday on penalty kicks. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers at the European Southern Observatory say they may have spotted two exoplanets sharing the same orbit around its star, located about 370 light years away. There are many celestial objects, such as asteroids and moons, that share the same orbit in our solar system. Using the ELMA radio telescope array, the scientists noticed a patch of debris that might be following an exoplanet twice the size of Jupiter called PDS-70b. The astronomers say this debris cloud could either be material that will form a new planet or the remains of one that already formed. While theorized by scientists years ago, this discovery may provide the first piece of evidence that planets can share the same orbit. The astronomers will check in on these possible co-orbiting planets again in 2026. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan was arrested at his residence in the eastern city of Lahore on Saturday after a lower court in the capital, Islamabad, convicted him of corruption. The decision, unless overturned, disqualifies the most popular Pakistani leader from running for office in upcoming elections. VOA Pakistan Bureau Chief Sarah Zaman reports.
Former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan was arrested shortly after a lower court in Islamabad found him guilty of corrupt practices, ending a nearly year-long trial. Khan was accused of selling state gifts worth $635,000 and deliberately concealing the proceeds. He was not present in court when the judge handed down a three-year prison sentence and a $350 fine. Khan's party, the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, called the verdict a black stain on the face of justice. In a message to supporters, party Vice President Shah Mahmood Qureshi said Khan did not get a fair trial.
Imran Khan did not get his fundamental right to a fair trial under Article 10A of the Constitution.
According to Pakistani law, Khan now is disqualified from running for office for 5 years, unless the conviction is overturned. Khan supporters say they can't think of an election without him.
Who will we vote for now? Who will we come out for? We can't think of elections without Imran Khan.
The information minister rejected the notion that the government influenced the verdict to keep him out of upcoming elections. Information Minister Mariam Aurangzeb said the verdict was not politically motivated.
He's a thief. He stole something. He was arrested. He will have to answer for it and face punishment. It has nothing to do with politics.
Despite a nationwide call for protest, the response from Khan's followers was slow. with few arrests reported early on. Analyst Zahid Hussain.
A kind of leadership is not there to organize any movement. And I think it's also the fear of state power that will desist people from coming out on the street.
Khan's arrest in May saw violent nationwide protests, including unprecedented attacks on military installations and buildings, followed by mass arrests of party workers and leaders, high-profile defections, and trials in military courts. This time, the leadership urged supporters to remain peaceful.
Do not destroy property. Do not take the law in your hands.
Hussain says the verdict may not hurt Khan's popularity, but it will erode faith in the country's already weak democracy.
There will be huge resentment among not only among his supporters, but even among those people who believe that democracy should be allowed to continue and democratic process should not be derailed.
Khan's legal team has announced it will appeal the verdict in higher courts. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Islamabad.
The UN Human Rights Office says it has been forced to close its office in Uganda and would officially cease operations in the country. We hear more from Lisa Schlein, reporting for VOA from Geneva.
UN Human Rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani tells VOA the government informed her office in February of the decision not to renew the host country agreement that allows the agency to work in the country.
In their view, Uganda was at a stage in its ability to manage the human rights situation where the UN Human Rights Office was no longer needed. We, of course, deeply regret this decision. We've been in the country for 18 years. We've threatened and we've tried to serve as a bridge between the government and civil society.
Shamdasani acknowledges Uganda has made progress on several human rights issues. For example, she notes that Uganda is the second country in Africa to adopt a national action plan on business and human rights. However, she adds many challenges and problems remain. She says human rights officials are particularly concerned about the situation ahead of the 2026 elections.
And we're already seeing concerns emerging about the shrinking of civic space and reports of political interference in the National Human Rights Institution in the lead up to the elections. We are worried. We're worried that there's an increasingly hostile environment for civil society actors, journalists, human rights defenders.
She warns the prevailing bellicose climate in Uganda is not conducive to free and fair elections. Shamdasani says the recent passage of Uganda's anti-homosexuality bill, which makes homosexual acts punishable by death, is of great concern.
It's deeply discriminatory and it's had already a corrosive effect on all of society. It's encouraging people to almost carry out witch hunts of lesbians and gays in Uganda. I mean, this is an example of a law which is in clear violation of Uganda's international human rights commitments.
Shamdasani says the UN Human Rights Office remains committed to working on human rights in Uganda. While UN officials no longer will be on the ground, she says they will continue to monitor the situation, but from a distance. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A Ukrainian film taking place during Russia's war on the country was recently screened before the U.S. Congress in Washington. It tells the story of two Ukrainian teens who were forcibly transferred to a Russian-occupied territory. Andriy Boris has this report, narrated by Anna Rice.
Nastya Mitrofanova and Masha Sinchuk are taking an evening stroll through Washington. Some 7 months ago, the Ukrainian teens were detained in prison-like conditions in Khmelnytskyi city in the Kherson region, which was then occupied by Russian forces.
We thought we'd be in yet another basement, not knowing what was to follow.
The two girls are the subjects of the documentary film Escape from Russians, produced by the investigative journalism agency Sledstvo.info. In late July, the film was presented to the U.S. Congress in Washington. The movie tells the story of the teens' 11 months in Russian custody. They were first forcibly taken to occupied Crimea, where they were held at a vocational institution, and Sinchuk says threatened for their pro-Ukrainian beliefs.
They summoned military police and threatened to sew our mouths shut with black thread if we voiced any support for Ukraine.
Thanks to volunteers and the investigation conducted by Slidstva.info, they managed to flee captivity and return to Ukraine.
We're coming, Ukraine!
The numbers vary, but Ukrainian officials say at least 16,000 Ukrainian children have been forcibly detained in Russia. Journalist Yulia Chimerik, who worked on the film, says international help is needed to bring them back to Ukraine.
When the system starts working, the Russians change it. That's why we didn't show details of the girls' rescue. We need help from volunteers and organizations that can do it instead of Ukrainians, because Russia doesn't work with Ukrainians.
The American politicians who attended the screening were moved by the girls' bravery and promised to help.
We'll be working with sanctions on the oligarchs, on the people who could be responsible for whatever is occurring. We will have every effort made to support international organizations, the Red Cross, others that can try to liberate the children.
Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur insists Russian authorities should be held responsible. But to do that, crimes must be documented, as they are in this film.
That a tribunal be established, and I think that it will be ultimately, probably at The Hague, in order to bring Russia to justice. And the names of children, the names of young people who have been abducted, who've been taken from their parents, in situations where parents have been killed, but then children were taken by Russia.
Before their abduction, the teens were studying to become chefs in Kherson. Today, they are telling their story to lawmakers in Washington, hoping to help other Ukrainians who are going through a similar ordeal. For Andrei Boris in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And speaking of films, we'll leave you with one on the lighter side. The Barbie movie joins the $1 billion club in its third straight record-breaking week since it hit U.S. theaters, also breaking a record for female directors. Associated Press entertainment correspondent Margie Zaraletta reports.
What's going on? Why are these men looking at me?
Yeah, they're also staring at me.
Barbie has earned another $53 million domestically this weekend, according to studio estimates. In just 3 weeks, it's made $1 billion globally. It was a close race for second place at the box office this week, but Meg 2 The Trench takes that spot. Oppenheimer is in third place, with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in fourth. Haunted Mansion is number five. I'm Margie Zaraletta.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, we thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great start of the week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For seven decades, the United States and Australia have worked together as allies. In Brisbane, at the 33rd Australia-U.S. Ministerial Consultations, known as AUSMIN, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said, "Our relationship has never been stronger or more important for us, and I would argue for the world." At a press briefing with U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong, and Australian Defense Minister Richard Marles, Secretary Blinken said that chief among the leaders' discussions was their commitment to a free, open, secure, prosperous, resilient, and connected Indo-Pacific.
A region where countries are free to chart their own path and to choose their own partners, where issues are dealt with openly, transparently, rules are decided together, they're applied fairly, goods, ideas, people can flow lawfully and freely.
To advance that goal, the U.S. and Australia are working not only with one another, but also through revitalized and new coalitions. For example, with India and Japan in the Quad, with the United Kingdom in AUKUS, and with elevated engagement with the Pacific Islands Forum. The work of these partnerships is manifold, including connecting more people to the internet and telecommunications infrastructure, enhancing maritime domain awareness, promoting sustainable and inclusive economic growth, and making communities more resilient to climate change. At the same time, said Secretary Blinken, our two countries are defending the international rules-based order.
We're doing that in part by engaging China, but also, as necessary, opposing its efforts to disrupt freedom of navigation and overflight in the South and East China Seas, to upend the status quo that's preserved peace and stability across the Taiwan Straits, to pressure countries through economic coercion or threats to their citizens.
The United States and Australia are also united in supporting Ukraine against Russia's brutal war of aggression. Australia's assistance continues to be critical to the fight for Ukraine's sovereignty, for its territorial integrity, for its future, said Secretary Blinken. Quoting President Joe Biden, Secretary Blinken said the United States has no closer or more reliable ally than Australia. Today, Ousmane, he declared, builds on our successful past and guides our work together to build a stronger, more secure, and more peaceful world for everyone.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.